You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Last week, the National Climate Assessment was issued. Now, a Washington State University researcher says some of the predictions could mean benefits, at least in the near term, for agriculture east of the Cascades. Steve Jackson reports.
Chad Kruger is the director of the WSU Center for Sustainable Agriculture and Natural Resources. He was a co-author of the agriculture chapter of the Northwest Climate Assessment, a summary of which was used to put together the national assessment. Most of that research focused on central and eastern Washington. Kruger says while the national summary indicated climate change would cause a decrease in agricultural yields in the next 50 years, there were some different results found for eastern Washington.
We're far enough north that a little bit of warming actually helps. And so, you know, some of our projections basically say out to about mid-century, the amount of warming that's projected is largely going to be a benefit to crop yield in our region.
Kruger adds that the increase in CO2 in the environment will be beneficial as well as compared to regions where corn is the main crop.
Whereas in the Pacific Northwest, our dominant crops are wheat, tree fruit, forages, potatoes, these kinds of crops, which do get that benefit. And so when you combine the fact that a little bit of warming is okay, and then we get almost a fertilizer effect from elevated CO2, we actually look pretty good in the Pacific Northwest, at least out to mid-century.
Kruger says there are a couple of caveats. In areas that are dependent on irrigation water, the warmer temperatures will likely affect mountain snowpack, and for places with problems getting water later in the year, that is likely to be a factor. He says the other issue is that researchers have only scratched the surface of what climate change might mean in terms of weeds and insect pests. Kruger says it's likely past the mid-century point the positive effects of climate change will be canceled out for our region when it comes to crop yields. He also says newly developed strains of crops may have a better time dealing with the changing climate 60 years down the road. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Marijuana legalization in Washington was sold to voters as a way to take money away from criminals and generate tax revenue for the state. This was one of the TV ads for Initiative 502 back in 2012.
We could tax it to fund schools and health care, free up police to go after violent crime instead.
But will the end of pot prohibition really mean the end of the black market? A man who's about to go to federal prison for growing and trafficking marijuana says it wouldn't have put him out of business. Correspondent Austin Jenkins has his story.
I'm standing with Scott Johnson, looking up at Bellingham's tallest building, the Bellingham Towers.
Opened May 9th, 1930. Tallest building north of Seattle, still today.
Sorry. There you go, I'm selling.
Johnson is one of those natural-born salesmen. He used to own a restaurant on the 15th floor of this building.
What was the name of the restaurant?
At first, it was called Top of the Towers.
Now, Johnson comes to Bellingham Towers to see his lawyer, whose office is also here. You see, Johnson's been sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for his role in a long-running marijuana production and distribution ring. Sitting in his lawyer's office, Johnson says before the Fed swept in, it was a lucrative line of business.
Were you part of the 1%?
I was part of the 1%.
There was a Lamborghini, a boat named Liquid Assets, jet skis, trips to Hawaii. Johnson ran a couple of grow operations. His business partners had a couple more. He would ship the marijuana, 70 to 80 pounds at a time, across the country.
It was packaged very well, placed into a mortar home, driven close to New York City, and then it was transferred and delivered other ways.
Johnson would fly to New York and supervise the transaction.
Yeah, put on a smiling face, put the suit and tie on, and go to work.
Literally the suit and tie?
Literally the suit and tie.
Johnson says in a good year, he could make upwards of $1 million. His profit margin was 65%. Since he couldn't pay taxes, he gave to charity. He kept his wife and twin daughters in the dark. And then the feds came calling.
Did you sort of assume in the back of your mind that this day would come?
I never believed that I'd see the feds sniffing around.
The feds put Johnson out of business. But what if they hadn't caught wind of his operation? Would pot legalization in Washington have got him instead?
Legalization wouldn't have put me out of business. It's not going to put anyone that's been doing this for a while out of business.
For the record, Johnson says he planned to become a licensed pot grower under Initiative 502.
I don't like lying to my family. I don't like, you know, cheating the government.
But if he couldn't get a license for some reason?
Definitely wouldn't have folded. I mean, I would have attempted to get the license. If that didn't work, I would have just continued on the mission.
And you think you still would have had a customer base and a business model that worked?
Very much so.
Johnson says he already weathered one storm in the pot business, medical marijuana. It drove down the price so much, that's when he started moving product to New York. He says to survive legalization, he might have had to expand his distribution to other states.
He can certainly grow pot in Bellingham and send it to Oregon or Chicago or New York.
That's UCLA's Mark Kleiman. He was Washington's marijuana consultant. He also co-authored the book on marijuana legalization, literally. But Kleiman does not believe illegal growers in Washington will continue to have a homegrown customer base.
How many moonshiners are there in Washington? How many illicit tobacco growers are there in Washington? Very hard for an illicit market to compete with an illicit market. It's just much cheaper to pay your taxes and do stuff above board.
But Scott Johnson isn't convinced that the new pot stores will immediately replace long-standing customer-dealer relationships.
I think that the majority of people are going to be getting it from their buddy that they've been getting it from for decades.
To test that theory, I went to Sylvester Park in downtown Olympia to conduct an informal survey. There I found 20-year-old Chris Baldwin and his friend Madison, who would not give her last name.
Because I have some legal problems.
They were sitting in the sun eating Triscuits, pepperoni sticks, and fruit leather. Both admitted to regularly smoking pot.
Have you guys used today?
Yeah, that would probably explain the food eating. Yeah.
You're high right now.
Yeah, I'm currently
somewhat.
A little baked.
A little baked.
Yeah.
I asked Chris and Madison if they plan to start buying their pot at the licensed stores when they open in Washington.
I think I might stick with my dealer.
Both are skeptical they'll get the quality and variety of marijuana they're accustomed to. And Madison doesn't want to be videotaped going into a marijuana retail store.
There's really no telling how they're going to be classifying people who buy it.
I asked them how much they pay now for pot.
Street prices on a gram would be like $10. Normally.
So what happens, I ask, if the price in the stores gets down to $3 a gram? That's the price Mark Kleiman predicts within 3 years. That sparks a debate.
Then all illegal grow-ups will go out of business. That's an absolute... I can guarantee that. Those kind of prices
only
are unmatched.
It's the same quality. If it's of the same quality, because
or
no one's going to...
lesser.
I'm not going to spend even $50 on a bunch of weed that's only going to get me and my friend high for a day. $50...
As for Scott Johnson, he's scheduled to check into federal prison in June. The date was delayed so he could watch his twin daughters graduate from high school. So when he gets out of prison, does he have any plans to get back into the pot trade?
As far as the black market, absolutely not.
Johnson says he would consider participating in the legal trade, but as a convicted felon, he's unlikely to get a license from the state. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
The return of warmer weather means the yearly exodus to Alaska by fishers and fishery workers is just around the corner. Thousands will leave for Alaska fisheries from Seattle, the home port for a large part of the fleet. Each year, newcomers to the fishing life discover life on board comes with little privacy or downtime. They'll be living in their workplaces aboard the ships. Crews have spent the last few weeks getting those ships ready. From Seattle, reporter Carolyn Adolph takes us inside one of them.
Half of all the seafood fished in the United States comes from the Alaska fishery. Seattle is its base, and the biggest players around here are the companies with catcher processor ships. They include Trident Seafoods, Glacier Fish Company, and American Seafoods. I'm staring up at one of their factory ships right now.
I'm Alan Davis. I'm the Safety and Compliance Director for American Seafoods. This is the Northern Eagle.
This is a ship that goes out empty and returns with a hold full of frozen fish.
Watch out right here.
In Alaska, she'll be hunting for pollock. Outside, she looks like she's already taken a beating. But she was painted only 2 years ago.
The work that we do is pretty rugged, and it doesn't take long for the paint to get chipped and it to look weathered.
Time to take a look inside.
What we can do is we can sprint up to the wheelhouse and we can start there and just work our way down.
With both of us on the gangway, the stairs start bucking. Alan Davis makes it up without incident, but he's a pro. First stops the bridge. From there, you can see into the depths of the ship, past the nets rolled up on the deck, and down to the factory floor. Inside, the wheelhouse doesn't actually have a wheel. There are plenty of devices for navigation and fish finding. Alan Davis says the technology means these ships can fill their holds in less time, meaning more efficiency. That's a company testing the ship's equipment. Everywhere there are wires exposed, hatches open, and people checking systems. When the ship sails, everything has to be right.
So,
at the chart table, Alan Davis shows me a map of the destination.
We can clear off a little bit here. So when the vessels go up to Alaska, they go to an island called Unalaska. Here, everybody calls it Dutch Harbor.
The Northern Eagle had a winter run up there. She came back in early April for shipyard time, maintenance, time to turn around and do it again. 145 people will be on this ship when it leaves Seattle for Dutch Harbor. They'll sleep in staterooms of four. They'll keep their wet gear in a locker that blows hot air up their boots to dry them out. And they'll eat at tables with edges on them so their plates don't slide off when there's weather.
These vessels are actually very rugged and built for heavy weather. And I've been on this boat in heavy weather. It rides very well. It is something you have to get used to, though.
We see the engine room, which gives off heat that helps cook the fish guts in the tanks that are steps away. Perfect for making fish food.
Let's go this way.
And then we arrive on the factory floor.
Ah, fish and diesel.
One of the interesting things about the ships when they're here in town, they smell worse than they do at sea. At sea, it smells fresh salt water. There's no real fish odor. There's no real real odor at all. But then when it comes back home, it can sometimes get flavorful.
That's one way to put it. The factory's deserted now, but 65 people work down here when the place is full throttle. Fish flow down the chutes until they encounter the machines that will separate them into useful chunks just as they twitch their last. Alan Davis makes it sound almost fun. He stands us at the sorting table just in front of the butter machine, every fish's worst nightmare.
As the driver, my job is to stand here, grab fish, put them into the slots in the conveyor, nose down, belly towards the machine, one after the other. As the spotter, your job is to correct any mistakes I make. So if I put the fish in backwards, you flip it over and give me a hard time.
The guts run onto the gut line, and the hunt for fish roe is on. 18 grades of caviar are sorted on the ship. The fillets are frozen and packed, and the fish destined for surimi. What's surimi again?
So surimi, the things that become imitation crab, imitation lobster, and other products like that.
They head off to be turned to a paste. So there it is, the stuff of fillet of fish, grocery store sushi rolls, and Friday night fish sticks. American Seafoods has 5 ships leaving this week, with a total of 700 people on board. Over the next few weeks, many more fishers will be springing into action. The salmon seiners will get going. Another year on the Alaska fishery. I'm Carolyn Adolph reporting.
Now we turn to an event taking place tonight that will be of interest to anyone interested in Astoria history. And to tell us about it, with me in the studio is Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. Good morning, Mac.
Good morning. Thanks for having me in.
Well, tonight in Astoria, we have a treat. The author Peter Stark coming to talk about his book about Astoria. But it's really more than just the founding of the city. It's kind of the adventure that went into the first people who came here.
Absolutely. It's a international story of intrigue and politics and wilderness survival and big money and death and challenges and all kinds of things. It's truly an adventure.
Well, I know since the bicentennial, you are so well-versed in the history. And this particular book, you know, it covers the sea journey and the land journey. And for those who don't know, could you kind of give a synopsis of those?
Sure. John Jacob Astor had this idea of creating a global network of fur trading, and he already had one. But he saw that establishing a permanent outpost at the mouth of the Columbia River, where Lewis and Clark had wintered, and there were some maps of, and fur traders were kind of familiar with this area, he thought if I could establish a permanent outpost there, that would be the first step in really making this global fur trade work a lot easier. You didn't have to just sail your ship up and down the coast trying to find Native Americans. If you were here permanently, you could trade with them, and then all you had to do is run your ships back and forth. And he was going to ship goods overland from St. Louis. But the first step was creating that first outpost right here in Astoria. And he sent a group by sea that arrived first in March of 1811. And then this group came by land from St. Louis. And they were supposed to show up about 6 months or so later. And both just had tons of turmoil and personality conflicts and adventures and challenges that they had to overcome, and it's a great story. It's an amazing story. And I've said for years somebody should make a movie about it, and I think if there's ever a movie made, it's going to be because Peter wrote this book.
And now the author is going to be in Astoria tonight at the Liberty, but this isn't just about the author and his book. This is about the Historical Society.
Yeah, it's kind of been nice. We had a local lady, Tara, that owns Coke Commercial, that invited him, that just read his book and loved it and saw that he was doing a book signing and a kickoff, I guess, to a book tour in Portland. And she thought, well, goodness, you're writing a book about Astoria. You need to be in Astoria. And she invited him. It's one of the reasons I love this town. And then I got wind of it and co-opted a little bit. I said, could this be our annual meeting? Because I have to have an annual meeting every year. And last year we had a fantastic one. I haven't been able to find an equal program. And this guy coming to town, everybody excited about his book. I thought, terrific. And a whole bunch of different partners came on board. Liberty Theater is cutting a real nice deal for us, so they obviously have to cover some expenses, but they're donating a lot of that, and the Cannery Pier Hotel is putting him up, and Clemente's is going to give him dinner, and just a lot of people jumped on board, so it was really a team and community effort. But officially, this is the Clatsop County Historical Society's annual meeting. It's free for anybody. There will be kind of a little five-minute State of the Union address from me about the Historical Society. But basically, we want to just be entertained and hear a great story. And then if people bring the book or buy the book, get it signed.
Great opportunity. The Historical Society is an important part of Astoria, and people coming here to visit are likely to encounter a lot of the things that you do, primarily with the museum and, of course, the Flavelle House.
Definitely. Yeah, we get we operate four different museums: the Uppertown Firefighters Museum, the Heritage Museum, and the Old City Hall, the Captain George Flavelle House, and then 4 years ago we opened the Oregon Film Museum in the Old County Jail. So for a small rural historical society, we own and take care of six buildings, operate four museums, and we do it on a kind of a shoestring budget of about $450,000 a year, and we welcomed 50,000 visitors last year to our museums.
And most of the people who do the welcoming are volunteers?
Definitely. We couldn't survive without volunteers. The Flavelle House is open 361 days a year. We have to have volunteers that greet our visitors and docent and a ton of volunteers that help behind the scenes in the archives and scanning photographs. We've got more than 35,000 photographs in our collection, and people researching an old home or something want to come in and find a photograph. And we need those to be cataloged so people can find them. There's just tons of different ways. We've got a guy that's been helping us for years now on carpentry. He's a carpenter by trade, retired fun, and just wanted to help out. And he comes in kind of religiously, 1 to 2 days a week. So there's lots of ways to volunteer. And we wouldn't do half the things we do without that volunteer support. And, you know, you mentioned the Flavelle House. And we just had Mother's Day tea and scones, of course, last week. And, you know, that's a great example of bringing the house to life and how important our volunteers are to us. We do an event in September as well called Old Fashioned Fun and Games on the Grounds, where we have all kinds of crafts and things from the time period, games. We make ice cream. We make apple. We have a apple press, so we make apple cider. We do butter making, rope making, but we also play tons of games from the time period as well. And it just brings the past to life. And that's something that a lot of people, I don't think, are expecting. They think it's just a house museum. I get to walk through and see an old house. But it's really that time period coming to life. And it's the story of the Flavelles in that house. And it's a great story. And that's why we do something like Tea and Scones, to bring the house to life a little bit. So you can almost picture what it would be like stepping in and having an afternoon tea with Nellie Flavelle. And maybe you play the piano and hear some music, or you hear some stories about some of the other families in town.
So you have some very inventive activities and fundraisers for people. One of the most unusual I've ever heard of is the one that you do called Talking Tombstones.
Oh, that's one of my favorites. We do it the last Sunday in October every year. Astoria Granite Works, Russ Hoare, has been sponsoring it from the very beginning. So a big shout out and thank you there. But we pick a cemetery. We get 10 volunteer actors to bring those people to life that are buried there. And they basically stand on that person's grave and tell their story for about 5 to 10 minutes. And we try and pick some characters, some real wacky characters. I always go to my archivist and say, give me a murder victim, a prostitute, or some kind of a scoundrel. And then we go from there. Grieving mother sometimes, but it's just a really fun event. And for me, one of the things that I love about it are cemeteries have become somehow a scary place. It's a place of death rather than a place of stories. And one of the reasons that cemeteries exist and why we have tombstones are to remember those people. And once upon a time, 100 years ago, it was a place you'd go for picnics and to reconnect with a lost loved one, and it was a place of joy, not a place of scariness or sorrow. And I kind of like this Talking Tombstones as a way to remind people that these cemeteries are filled with people that led lives and have great stories, and we shouldn't forget those stories.
So there are a lot of opportunities as a volunteer, everything from archival activities, opportunities for actors, docents.
Definitely. I mean, we have needs from docenting to stuffing envelopes. I mean, there's always something that can be some way to contribute. We've got some folks that just bake for some of our tea and scones. We've got folks that'll just want to be called on once a year to volunteer in an event, and that's fine too. Some people are regular. I'll do a shift every Tuesday afternoon all year round, and other people just want to, I'll come and give you 2 hours when you need it for something specific. And you know, all of our nonprofits, KMUN is no different. All the nonprofits in town, we wouldn't survive without the graciousness and good-natured and excited enthusiasm of volunteers that are caring enough to give a little bit of their time to make our community a little better.
Some of the best things we have in the community are done by volunteers.
Definitely.
Well, if you're interested in becoming a volunteer for the Clatsop County Historical Society, you'll be able to meet many of your fellow volunteers at the event this evening. And could you recap that one?
Tonight at the Liberty Theater, Peter Stark, the author of a new book about Astoria and the founding of Astoria, the fur trade, and John Jacob Astor, and little Thomas Jefferson as well, Thomas J. He was involved in the whole thing. But it'll be a great time. It's free, 7 o'clock tonight. Your only price is that you got to listen to about 5 minutes of me talking before we'll turn it over to Peter. Doors will open at 6:30 or 6:45, somewhere in that range, and we'll start the show at 7 o'clock. And he's given great interviews. I have not met him yet personally, but I've seen him on a couple of different things, and he's a wonderful speaker, and the book is a really good read. It's an adventure novel with some really good research done into it.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mac Burns, for coming in and speaking with us today.
Well, thank you, and I hope we see a lot of people tonight.